That's what we're doing here on WGN on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll be here until 12 noon. Terry Savage, the savvy financial columnist, joins us Wednesdays at this time. We've been asking Terry to stay until quarter till, but we get her for just the first half hour of the show today. So right now, 312-981-7200 is the telephone number to call. We'll be talking about commercial real estate, too. Are you a renter? Does your business occupy some space in a building? What to expect? And if you hold those leases, what are you going to get for rents these days? More of that coming up in the next half hour. Terry Savage, more on the personal side today, as we often take calls from people who have questions about the stimulus program or their unemployment insurance claims and benefits. Plus, some new documents we'll be getting in the mail. You mentioned a couple of them in your most recent column, Terry.
Yeah, let me make two key points before we go to those questions quickly. First of all, a new rule goes into effect, actually went into effect yesterday. It's SEC Reg BI. It stands for Best Interest. And while they don't make stockbrokers and anybody who calls themselves advisors, they don't make them fiduciaries yet. They do have a new rule. And part of that BI, best interest rule, says that, number one, they must reveal their entire history of the background, financial, disciplinary records, and so forth. And beyond that, they need to have a conversation and make sure you read documents that explain your relationship and how they make their money. And not only is they're going to be so covering their derrieres on this that they're going to be taping these calls. So if you have a stockbroker, you can expect to get a call. You might think it's a casual thing, but this is their background to prove that they have indeed discussed how they get paid. Was it commissions? Is it fees? Is it both? Are all those commissions revealed? It's your moment to ask any questions. They're great, great brokers who always put their customers first. And there are a lot of people out there selling stuff to you that don't reveal how they make more money, perhaps, than you even might on those products. So this is going to be interesting to see the rollout of Reg BI. If they call you and start chatting, you ask all the questions you have.
Right. It's not just, hey, I know it's your birthday and we thought we'd just check in. If they already have a fiduciary responsibility, though, do they still have to do this, or is it presumed that they've already got this covered?
No stockbrokers have a fiduciary responsibility. Not yesterday, not tomorrow, or not the next week. There are many of them. I know a lot of them. 40 years ago, I was one of them who really cared more about the clients than the money I made. But the fact is that no stockbroker is obligated to be a fiduciary, put your interests first, and fully disclose. Now they have a best interest rule, and they're going to be discussing the commissions and fees with you.
I understand.
Only a registered investment advisor who signs a fiduciary pledge to put your interests first and fully disclose all fees and commissions, put that on their letterhead. That's the only person you know is not trying to, is guaranteed not to try to rip
But
you
I'm
off
interested this. In this idea. So will either group or both groups be, in fact, making personal overtures to their clients? And
they must. They must send out these forms, form CRS, which they have to file, disclosing any reportable legal or disciplinary history. They must give it to all new customers and prospective clients, including if they're just offering you advice on your 401k rollover or withdrawals. This is really going to be policed by FINRA, the self-regulatory agency. And in addition to that, you'll get the documents that are part of a discussion. Not fine print, but a real serious discussion about issues like fees and commissions.
That's really interesting news, and doesn't have anything to do with COVID, the pandemic, or maybe unemployment insurance benefits. But you may have a question about that now, too. Let's update folks on a couple of things. Then we'll come back. Terry, we'll take your calls. 312-981-7200. I'm reading at NBCNews.com. The $600 federal unemployment benefits end this month. GOP senators say enough already. What's the bet on this one? Are we going to get another $600 a week or not? Terry Savage joins us Wednesdays at this time. Lots of questions for you, Terry. So let's quickly just get your reaction to, do you think the Senate is going to approve another $600 a week?
I think that's iffy. But this is an election year. They're trying to buy your vote. And so I'm sure something will be coming along. Remember, Congress goes on recess, like kindergarten, Friday, and they don't come back till the 20th of July. So in order for them to continue that, they're going to have like 10 days before that law expires, about $600 a weekly additional benefit. So I know they're going to fall all over themselves that last week in July, but it won't get done, I don't think, until then, if anything. It may be a smaller benefit is my thought.
Mm, yeah, that's interesting. The president said he'll sign it. The Democrats in the House like it. Who thought they'd ever be in line? It's the Senate Republicans that aren't on page, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Democrats in the House want to, you know, are ready to write a check for anything. Or it's not their money, after all. And the Republicans are thinking, wait a minute, people want to stay home and collect their benefits. This is a bad incentive. So there's a... But overriding it all, remember, election coming up. So that's why I bet on something happening for people. $600 is going to be hard to justify. I bet there'll be a compromise.
1219 on WGN. Let's start with Art. You're on the air, Art, with Terry Savage. Hi.
Oh, hi, John. Hi, Terry. How are you?
Good.
Let me be brief here. In 2017, I retired from the State University Retirement System. I've supplemented my income by teaching their part-time, one or class a semester sort of thing. And I also had other employment, which was canceled due to COVID. So I applied for state unemployment.
I'm ahead of you. I'm ahead of you, Art.
Okay.
Art,
well,
I'm ahead of you. Because you're receiving a pension from a W-2 job that that you are not having anymore, despite having any other side income, you are ineligible for unemployment benefits. A very weird quirk in Illinois' law. If you're getting a pension from the company that you're still, then you come back to work,
mm-hmm.
you're out of work. You may be out of work from three other jobs, but that automatically disqualifies
even
you.
If that's less. The pension is less, the unemployment would have been more.
Not even the point. Not even the point.
Does this also preclude me from PUA assistance?
You can't get PUA assistance unless you were turned down for unemployment. But,
which sounds like is the case.
Yeah, which is the case, but I think that is a precluding case. I'm not 100% positive. So you can go back to the PUA, and if you had 1099s from last year, you can try and submit that as income. But I think that overriding thing, as I read the rules, and I've got it right on the computer in front of me, is that absolutely disqualifies you.
If you're ineligible for unemployment benefits, then you're not eligible for PUA.
Well, that's not true. You have to be declared ineligible. But I think this one criteria seems to... Try it. Art, try it and call back in a week or two and let us know.
So go ahead and file for PUA, even though I can't get through.
File for PUA because you were turned down. And then they'll go back and look, and I think they're going to deny it, is what I'm saying. But you could try. I'd love to see you get it based on your other side jobs that have nothing to do with the university from which you're receiving a pension.
I would, too. All right. I'll give that a try.
Good luck to you, Art. Thanks for the phone call. Sorry, that's 2 weeks in a row. We've got a version of that. I don't mind hearing it twice.
No. People are all having these issues, for sure.
What about Kathleen? You're on WGN with Terry Savage. Kathleen, go ahead.
Yes, I'm so happy to talk to you, Terry, and John, of course.
Hello, yes, I'm right here.
Yeah, I know, okay. But anyway, I am 58 years old. I have, my stocks are in Vanguard. I have not switched anything around in my 401k. Everything stays the same. I'm wondering, I am like stupid on the stocks. I mean, actually, what to go to and what not to do. I'm asking advice. Do I switch them to something else?
Okay, let me say this, Kathleen. You're still working. You're 58. Just the odds. The IRS actuarial tables say you've got 20 years ahead of you. And for sure, you've got 15 until you're going to retire and be required to withdraw at 72. So you've got a long time ahead of you, and you need to know what funds, you're not in stocks, I mean, you're in stock mutual funds, what funds you're invested in inside your Vanguard 401k. And what you need to do is call the HR department and say, first of all, you need to look at your statement. And if you're in the aggressive stock fund, you might want to move it into something called the equity income fund or probably a target date retirement fund. But you're not taking money out of your 401k. You might want to be a bit more conservative in your choice of funds inside the 401k. And they probably don't have anything really safe like a money market, maybe a stable value fund. And you've got 20 years, and I'll leave you with this thought. There's never been a 20-year losing period in the stock market for a portfolio of large company stocks with dividends reinvested. That would be your S&P 500 index fund. Never, even adjusted for inflation. So you need the growth in the stock market. What you do need, Kathleen, outside, is to build up some cash so that you have a cushion and you can just let your money be invested for the long run in your 401k.
Kathleen, good luck, and thanks for the call. Speaking of cash, so as to insulate yourself from some of the fluctuations, particularly the downside lately, what do you think about taking some money, keeping it in your 401k, but taking it out of equities, putting it in a cash position so that you do have a pool of money?
John? Once you're in your 401k.
I know. Okay, never mind then.
As you're working for the company, you can only invest in their choices. And very few 401ks have a money market fund, which would be equivalent to cash. Many have something called a stable value fund, which says it'll yield about 2 or 3%. And if you're within 2 or 3 or 4 years of retirement, that's a good idea. Inside your 401k, the safest thing you can find will be that stable value fund. But again, remember, if you're still in your 50s or 60s, you need some stock market exposure because, number one, it's always been a long-term good bet. Number two, it beats inflation.
All right, but I'm thinking, Terry, I'm thinking about people who right now are worried that suddenly my income gets cut off. I get fired or the company goes belly up or something happens these days. And now I wish I had put some cash on the side for this eventuality. And
yeah, but it can't be inside your 401k.
Okay.
That's exactly what I said to Kathleen. Go open a bank account, a money market fund, where they pay you next to nothing. And see if you can't save $500 and then $1,000 and then $5,000. And pretty soon you will know, number one, you'll complain, but I'm not earning anything, Terry. And
right.
I'm saying, but you are sleeping well at night with that amount. For some people, it's $10,000. Some people, it might be $100,000.
Well, that's why I'm asking, even if it's outside the 401k, take it out of equities right now, even though you might miss an uptick, because you'll lock in at least some cash and you'll insulate yourself from a downside.
Chicken money. That's the absolute definition of chicken money.
Well, I'm not saying that's... I'm asking you, is that maybe not a bad idea right now with just with 6 months rent or something like that?
I have always said you should at least have 6 months to a year's living expenses on the side. That's a luxury that many people can't afford. They can't pay a $400 bill if the car breaks down and the refrigerator goes. So it depends on who you're talking to, but always... I can tell you that having chicken money gives you the courage to stick with your investment plan because you go, well, all right, let me look at it again in 3 months when I get my statement.
I'm going to take Mary on line three for Terry Savage. You're on WGN. Mary, go ahead.
The website says I'm eligible for a stimulus check, but so far I have not received one.
Mary, do you get Social Security?
Yes.
It should come. Did you also file a tax return?
Yes, for 2018 and 2019.
Okay, you will get your stimulus, and if you don't, by the middle of July, you can go to my terrysavage.com website and post a question, and I'll get back to you and get your information. But they're still paying out both Social Security, stimulus-based payments, and even those who filed tax returns. If you didn't move, Mary, that's important, and you still have the bank account open where you might have had direct deposit, you should still get that. But if you don't, and by the way, when they send out the stimulus check, everyone, within 2 weeks they must send a letter saying, hi, Mary, we're the government. We sent your stimulus check. We had it automatically deposited in that, you know, a Chase Bank that you used in 2018, or we sent it to 123 Oak Street. If you never receive your check, but you do get that letter, I'm going to write another column in another couple of weeks. There's a form that you can fill out so that you can track a lost stimulus check.
Interesting to know. Let us know, Mary. You should get it. It's not the first week that Terry Savage has said to someone, be patient. Teresa, go ahead,
Before
Terry.
We go,
yeah,
I want to make one point. You just talked about chicken money. I was thinking about bringing this up. I just want you to point out that gold today traded over $1,800 an ounce, and then it backed off. It's now about $1,775 or $76 an ounce. That's an 8.5-year high. Gold stocks had their best quarter in 20 years. Now, gold is not where you flee with all your money because you think the world is crashing, because if the world crashes, you have a lot more problems than gold can give you. But one of the other things that you might all think of doing, and the last time I wrote about gold in my columns, I just looked on my website, was January 9th, 2019, and I wrote, as I write this, gold is trading at $1,291 an ounce. So today we're about $1,800. And I talked about how to buy gold stock mutual funds. That might be another hedge against the stock market itself, even though gold's already moved up. When gold takes off, it takes off. I have no idea whether it'll go back down again first, but gold mining stocks tend to pay dividends, especially as the price of gold gets higher. So just a Terry's tip.
An interesting point. 60 seconds. Teresa, you're on WGN. Go ahead.
Yes, I've got a question regarding a sale of my 80-year-old father's house within the next couple of months. He will probably end up moving in with one of his family members. What, if anything, needs to be done with the proceeds from the sale of that house, like for taxes, or does he have to roll it over into something so he's not taxed so high? How does that happen?
I'll give you a quick answer. First of all, he's not married now, so he can exclude $250,000 worth of gains. You have to go back and trace. We bought the house in 1953, but we put $42,000 to do the kitchen, another $60,000 to remodel this, that, or the other. So you have a cost basis. When he sells it, he excludes $250,000 of gains, and then he's taxed at ordinary income rates. Some people say that under the current law, it would be better not to sell it until he dies, because then his heirs get the value of the house at the step-up basis, the value as of the date of death under current law, which may change if the Democrats get in. So, and when you get the money, whether you do it now or later, you put it in a bank in a money market fund account. Is the state paying for his, he's going to live with family members? Whoever he lives with should be able to draw on that money to pay for help to come in and help care for him. But again, you need either to think about his estate plan and whether you can leave that house empty or let somebody live in it, let him, if he's not going to live very long and he has a huge gain, if he paid all in $412,000 but he's going to sell it for $982,000, be better dying with it in his name so that the step-up basis applies and that all gain is tax-free.
What if they want the cash, though? What if they want that or he wants that money?
You asked me a sophisticated question in 60 seconds. If you need the cash, you do the cost valuation plus all the additions they put in over the years. You say there's $300,000 worth of gains when we sell it. $250,000 of the gains is excluded. $50,000 gets added onto his income, which could maybe bump up the cost of Medicare Part B or other plans. So you really have to give this some serious thought with the tax. A CPA should look into that for you.
Mm. Terry Savage, you can email her, terry@terrysavage.com, and visit terrysavage.com for stuff like this. Let's talk next week, Terry. As always, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
That's Terry Savage. Some folks say, I would imagine most folks say, best popcorn in the city is Garrett's. But at a time where people don't want to stand in line or need to socially distance, well, that's part of us. That's a staple of the Garrett experience. You know that you're going to wait for that fresh popcorn and you're going to wait in line and the line moves, but there you are in line. So what happens? I went by a Garrett's not that long ago. They were closed, but I believe they are opening now. To tell us more about that, Adrian Cardos joins us, Vice President of Marketing and Integrated Brand Management for Garrett Popcorn. You can go to GarrettPopcorn.com. And by the way, a lot of folks are thinking maybe they'd like some for party packs. A lot of food is being delivered that way. Maybe even your 4th of July thing, if you can get it online. Adrian, it's John, and you're on the air. How are you today?
Hi, I'm well, John. How are you?
Really good. Are your stores open? Have they been open? What's the story?
We have 3 open as of today. So we do have 3 downtown shops open, and we are working to open more as quickly as we're able.
One is very near the radio station, as I recall. It's just off of Michigan Avenue, right?
That's right. We have we have 3 opening downtown. So one at Navy Pier, one right off Michigan Avenue, and then one over off of Jackson in the Loop. And then we have another shop down in the Chatham neighborhood at 87th Street in Cottage Grove.
The Navy Pier one just opened today, right?
That's right.
So those three are open. So if I order online, I would then go pick it up at those locations, correct?
Yes, that's something new we introduced just recently. So you can now, as you said, go online. You can order and pay online. And when you get to the shop, you can skip yourself right to the front and give them your information. And we can make it almost as contactless as possible to get you out of the shop.
Sounds like the Portillo's model. Can I, in fact, come right up to the store without having ordered in advance, or do I need to order in advance?
You can do both. So if you come to a shop, we have redesigned several of them to allow for more social distancing. We've even updated some of our countertops to keep everything fresh and clean. We've been around for 70 years, so we know how to keep you safe and know how to keep your popcorn fresh and clean. But we are absolutely helping to take extra precautions. So if you come in person, we're happy to help you. 87th Street does have a drive-through, which is brand new. Or if you order online, like I said, you can come right in and skip the line.
I'm reading now, maybe this is your website, I think. Garrett Popcorn Shops have introduced new packaging for the orders placed online to preserve the freshness. What are you guys doing differently there?
Oh, you might be referring to our parade packs, which are only online. Longtime Chicagoans know that we have participated in the parades in November and December here in Chicago, and we tend to toss individually sized bags of Garrett Mix into the waiting fans as we come down the route.
Right.
Well, with everything going on right now, we thought we would set that packaging up again and offer them to fans now. So even though we're all celebrating and parades look a lot different these days, you can still get Garrett Mix in a smaller bag. You're able to kind of hand them out to family and friends as you're heading out for your own picnics this weekend.
Yeah. Have I been able to order online previously, though, and you would mail me the popcorn, or have you guys been shut down during the COVID?
Oh, great question. We do have an online website, as you've been referring to. And, man, during the shutdown, we were able to keep our kitchen open that does do online orders. And that was really phenomenal. We were so inspired by and impressed with our fan base. People were ordering it for home, you know, to kind of break up the stay-at-home order. We had people sending it to family that they couldn't see, you know, during weddings or birthdays. And we even had businesses reaching out to Garrett to help them send to employees while everyone is pulling double duty, working at home, teaching from home, parenting from home, all of those things. So our website was doing really well, and we were able to keep it open this entire time.
Doesn't that popcorn sound good right now?
Really.
What are you, in marketing? So I'm going to guess that the caramel is your best seller, the cheese is the second, and the butter popcorn is the third?
That's a pretty good guess, although, you know, longtime Chicagoans love to mix the caramel crisp and the cheese corn together.
Yeah, I do the three-way myself. Is that the Garrett mix, or is that something different?
That's your own. The three-way sounds like your own special mix, but I tend to agree with you. The buttery one that you mentioned is vegan. And so I know one of my daughters in particular, that's her favorite recipe.
Okay, so Garrett Popcorn, they're up and running. Can you share with me a last question? Employees or dollars up or down? I mean, how much have you lost, say, since the middle of March?
Yeah, you know, we're a tiny family company, so we don't talk about that. But like every other Chicago business, it's definitely a difficult time, and we're just so happy to be open again. And we're really proud of the city and the state for how we're handling it, moving forward smartly so that we don't have to go backward.
GarrettPopcorn.com. GarrettPopcorn.com. Go get yourself some. Okay, nice to talk
Thank
to you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Adrienne. Stay well.
Yeah, you too. Happy 4th.
Adrienne Cardoche is the Vice President of Marketing, can you tell? And Integrated Brand Management at Garrett Popcorn. Time for the Wintrust Business Minute. Steve Bertrand.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Illinois is tied with Massachusetts for the 11th worst economy during coronavirus. That's according to Bank Rates Housing Hardship Index. It looked at mortgage delinquency and unemployment to come up with the number. By those standards, Nevada's economy is the worst. We're still shopping the frozen food aisle. ConAgra Brands said it's investing more in manufacturing capacity as demand for its packaged foods remains strong during the pandemic. ConAgra says its comparable sales were up 22% in the quarter that ended May 31st, and they've been going up since then. And Lightship Capital has announced what is likely the largest ever venture capital fund dedicated to investing in Midwestern minority-led startups. Chicago Inno says it's a $50 million fund. I'm Steve Bertrand. That's the Wintrust Business Minute.
Orion Samuelson's looking at the markets on the agribusiness side, oh?
Still looking at green screens after that USDA report on planted acreage yesterday. The July wheat contract is trading higher. It's up 6.25 cents, trading at 4.96 and a half. July corn is up 10.25 cents, trading at 3.48 and a quarter a bushel. July soybeans are up 10.25, trading at $8.94 and a half a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, July lean hog contract is trading lower. It's down 27 cents a hundredweight, $44.90. But August live cattle trading up $1.22 at $97.50. And the August feeder cattle contract is up 75 cents, trading at $132.92 a hundredweight. Well, finally, on the first day of July, after years of negotiating and discussions and meetings, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA, officially entered into a force, a culmination of years of work to update and improve the North American Free Trade Agreement. Darren Armstrong, who is chairman of the U.S. Grains Council, said, "This agreement solidifies our country's most important and strategic trade relationships with our best customers and promises further economic growth in tandem with our most valued partners, Mexico and Canada. We're looking forward to improved agricultural trades between the three countries." And the market for farmland has remained pretty steady throughout the coronavirus-driven economic turmoil, as demonstrated by the recent 3,070,000 auction of 320 acres in Delaware County, Indiana. That's near Muncie. R.D. Schrader, president of Schrader Real Estate and Auction Company, reported today that farmland remains a rare haven from the economic chaos roiling so many assets. And while the recent volume of land sold has been lower compared to other periods, the demand has remained very strong. In the Delaware County, Indiana auction, almost 60% of the land, that's 191.5 acres, sold to a farmer for $1.77 million. That's $9,243 per acre. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
Eric Feinberg is on a phone line. We want to talk a little bit in this last segment of today's Wintrust Business Lunch about the commercial real estate market. The commercial real estate side is up for grabs as much as anything else is these days. As we reimagine the workforce in America, if folks aren't coming downtown or coming down to big buildings, maybe they prefer smaller buildings. What's happening and what is going to happen? Eric is the vice chairman and co-head of the Chicago region for Savills, and let's talk a little bit about the business side of this. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what do you guys do, though? Do you hold the leases? Are you a landlord, or do you just help businesses manage those buildings?
Well, what we do, John, is we advise large corporations and users of real estate, specifically focused on the office industrial markets or users. And so we'll advise large companies, law firms, not-for-profits, schools on how they utilize their real estates, whether that's a lease or own situation.
And what's the trend right now? What's happening there?
Good question. Not to be glib, but not very much. It's a very slow time, as you can imagine, while organizations really adjust to or try to figure out what the new normal is. And what I mean by that is, you know, folks are trying to figure out, you know, what pricing is going to exist and what their people are going to be doing in the future. Are they going to be working from home more? Are they going to be coming to the office? Are they going to be coming to buildings? But right now, every long-term decision that companies are considering has really been put on hold.
Are people sitting then on their leases and not renewing them? And maybe the landlords are nervous about whether or not they are going to get another year or five-year contract, right?
Exactly. Well, leases do come up, and when they do have an expiration during this time, what organizations are trying to do is really just put in short-term solutions, really just put in on a one-year or two-year lease. But very few are looking at long-term transactions at this point in time until they can really figure out what the new normal is.
And that's for people renting the space. What about people that buy space or build their own buildings?
That's also a good question. So construction was deemed an essential activity, so construction has continued during this pandemic period, and it's actually been almost more efficient than it was before as far as scheduling goes, because not a lot of work, there were very few interruptions to their work, I might say. Any new speculative development has really been put on hold for the time being. And as far as owners go, from a capital market standpoint, that has also really been slow, almost at a standstill, as you can imagine. Because if you can't predict what your future cash flow is, it's really difficult to predict what the future valuation of the current valuation of your building is.
I was looking at your site, and it seems to me like, if I may just quote from it, you say smaller scale buildings will become greater competition to larger scale buildings. Zombie buildings, you talk a little bit about. A zombie building, I presume, is a building that nobody's in right now?
Well, what we see from when we refer to a zombie building, it basically refers to a building that has an ownership structure that might be in trouble, right? And so that they're going to be having trouble making their debt payments due to uncertainty with current or future cash flow. And as such, they can't really do any deals or any transactions. So they don't have the money to fund future deals. And we saw that in the financial crisis in 2008-2009. And with some debt coming due and some uncertainty around, you know, current cash flow, that's a situation where we might see happen again.
If I was thinking, well, when I'm a business manager, I want to rent or I want to buy, maybe, or where whatever my options are, work from home, my guess is that rents will be lower moving forward. Is that your expectation?
That is our expectation. We do believe there's going to be a repricing in the Chicago commercial real estate markets. How deep that is a little bit unknown right now. There are just so many variables coming into play. But we do expect there to be a repricing in the Chicago real estate markets, both from a leasing perspective as well as from an investment sales perspective.
Is it possible that they won't take commercial real estate at all, but they'll tell people to work at home and invest the money in that kind of technology?
That's a great question. We do not see the disappearance of the office at all. And we think, you know, people crave that human interaction. And while work from home is going to be a part of every organization's workplace strategy, it's not going to be the end-all be-all. I mean, if you think about, you know, the new employee, the new graduate from college who's entering your organization, Those folks need that interaction. They need to be exposed to the corporate culture. They don't move to a city like Chicago to be stuck in their studio or one-bedroom apartment. They need the office. And so while we don't see a disappearance of it, we do see a slight dislocation, a short-term dislocation, and we do believe that it will come back after the pandemic is over.
I saw a meme this week, and it was work from home is actually live at work. Work from home, you get that, but what you end up doing now is living at your workplace, your home, and it's 24/7, and it's exhausting to people. Whatever their efficiency is, they can't escape it, and they want to. So perhaps the pendulum is going to swing that way. Do you imagine people are still going to come downtown into the big cities, or will there be little hubs in the suburbs?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and there's a little bit of an unknown surrounding that. A lot of companies are talking about providing a different model instead of a centralized location, whether that be downtown Chicago or downtown New York, providing other opportunities to attract workforce, and you know, it's a risk mitigation strategy, as well as an opportunity to offer amenity to your workforce. And so we do believe that is going to occur for a certain segment of the user base.
I know, Eric, you've also said that we're previously, like 10 minutes ago, we were thinking you want recreation, you want food stations. It's health and safety that are going to drive a lot of these new building layouts, right?
Exactly. That's the key marketing component of a lot of the new buildings that are coming online right now, as well as what everyone's first question is. And so, John, I think you asked, or you mentioned a little earlier in our conversation, the smaller buildings that are being developed right now. And if you look at some of the big high-rises here in downtown Chicago and some of the challenges to manage those high-rises and to get up to your workspace, that's a health and safety concern for some folks, versus, looking at a smaller building where you might be able to manage your transportation and your day a little bit better.
I think about that. Eric Feinberg, Vice Chairman at Savills, visit S-A-V-I-L-L, Savills.us to get more expertise like this. It's nice to talk to you today, Eric. Thanks for helping us out.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate it.
You have a good weekend.